This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Nick, I wanted you on my show, and when I invited you, you said yes, but there's a condition. You want to ask me questions.
I do indeed. You know, it's been 16 years since I was last in China. At that time in my life, I spent quite a lot of time there because I was starting up a business there, a subsidiary for one of the South African banks. And so I won't say that I was had an opportunity to be deeply steeped in the culture or anything to that extent, but I did travel quite widely and had a lot of meetings, and you know, we were really trying to understand as well as we could what the lay of the land was. So it was a reasonable exposure. And since then, I've had just an incredible paucity of opportunities to talk to people who have, you know, been thoughtful people who have visited China and done a little bit of traveling and so on. You get a lot of people coming back saying, wow, you know, I was in Shanghai and the buildings are amazing, you know. Well, that hardly gives you any insight. And you start asking them a question of or two about, like, well, tell me about the surveillance state. Tell me about, you know, and they don't have any insight. They haven't even crossed their mind that there was something like that to discuss, you know.
Look, this is the thing. So first and foremost, I just want to point out, because whenever we have a discussion like this, people say, oh, but if you're just a tourist, it doesn't mean anything. You don't get any insight. No, I think you do. You get a keyhole, but it's a keyhole nonetheless. It's sure. Better than nothing.
Yes. But I think what you can definitely get very quickly is if a very false impression has been created in the public imagination. You know, that every time you move, you've got to swipe your digital ID, and if you jaywalk, you get knocked off. You know, that's the kind of impression that I think many people have. I remember, if we just go back, there were two crazy psyops in the early stage of the COVID phenomenon involving China. The first one, which was the one that had the biggest impression on me, was the famous Falling Man video, you know, where this guy's like walking along the street and then all of a sudden it's and plunks, he falls over, you know, and we're all meant to believe that this is what the novel deadly virus does, you know, and for many observers at the time, that was actually the thing that woke them up and said, hold on, what's going on here? This isn't real. Why are we seeing this material? It's on Twitter, not, you know, a platform that ostensibly doesn't really exist in China. It doesn't appear to be of Chinese origin. Who's circulating this material and to what end? So that was the first one. And then the second one was the notion of the draconian Chinese lockdown. You know, it didn't take long to dispel that one completely. A few phone calls to people to say, well, yeah, what's going on? Are you guys locked down? And no, we're not locked down. It looked like there was a real showboating lockdown going on. And then the funny thing again, the material purporting to record this draconian lockdown did not appear to be of Chinese origin. So what was going on? And so I think China and conditions on the ground in China and the nature of the surveillance state there, the nature of the Communist Party and so on, we are once again, as is often the case, swimming through a sea of diversion and misinformation. Under those conditions, I think a visit by even remotely curious mind can do a lot to dispel these notions.
I went to, I think, 9 Chinese cities, and I spend most of my time in the province of Xinjiang, which is by far the most militarized and the most politically sensitive. And you get a very different perception there than what you do in Shanghai. So I think Shanghai, we can all agree, is just a mega city. It's very, very similar to any other big city in the world. It doesn't have the kind of draconianism that you would see on X. At the moment, there seems to be this concerted campaign, this anti-China, what do you call it, Sinophobic operation. This is very concerning. It's clear to me that China is a geopolitical target. And in the same way that we have to always be vigilant with everything that gets thrown at us, this is another one of those that we need to be vigilant about. The whole idea of digital ID has just suddenly, like in Lord of the Rings, where the focus of Sauron, the eye, just changes. And suddenly, what frustrates me, Nick, is I was there. Mm. I saw with my own eyes, and I spoke to people, and I asked them all these sorts of questions. And still, coming back home, people go, it's all rubbish. This video on YouTube is the truth. Yeah, it's like this unbelievably tough nut to crack.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember there was this fellow who gave off in every way the air of a CIA asset, Michael Singer, who was wrote the book, trying to pin the entire COVID phenomenon on China. And it came out pretty quickly. It was remarkably well put together, supposedly by a guy operating completely alone with no support staff, no funding, whatever. He writes this book. And he also put these incredible palettes together of social media posts that were being amplified in a sort of human bot fashion. So there'd be actual real South Africans, for example, promoting some post about how we needed to lock down and we needed to do the right thing and look after the elderly and whatever. And the posts would have this remarkably similar language and would suddenly appear, people would pick up, amplify exactly the same message. So, I mean, the stuff was interesting, but he was a one-trick pony. You could say whatever you wanted to about the COVID phenomenon as long as it implicated China. And so I think that's part of the same phenomenon here.
Yeah, definitely. I remember, I think I was driving to the city of Kashgar. I might have my cities wrong, but I think it was to Kashgar when you and I chatted on WhatsApp and you asked me, do you see these things that are on social media? Yeah. And the answer is yes and no. This is where you, I think, have hit the nail on the head so many times. We're dealing with complex systems. Mm. If we're dealing with a country that has, technically 5 time zones or 4 time zones, and it's the size of the US and it's got 1.5 billion people, you can't apply a single word descriptor to the whole thing. It's just ridiculous.
Yes.
You're dealing with separate provinces.
Within the system as well.
Yes. Massive. And just between the provinces, Shanghai has got 30 million people, right? Then you've got the province of Xinjiang. Just that province is 1.3 times larger than South Africa.
Yeah. So I mean, it's a fascinating thing that, because if you speak to Americans, they'll have no problem acknowledging that the culture in San Francisco is very different from the culture in Houston, that they can imagine very easily, and that life on the ground is quite different in those two places. That's not a difficult notion for them to comprehend, or it's unremarkable observation, but when it comes to this unknown blob, this massive space on the map, there's an imagined homogeneity that is completely incompatible with just any kind of country or reality. Yeah, it's just this imagined, uniformity. And I think that is kind of what's exploited when trying to create this idea of a monolithic communist beast.
I noticed, I don't know if you saw this when you were in China, but the Chinese people, when you speak to them, they don't care about these words like communist or socialist or capitalist. They don't care. They're just practical people for the most part. They just want to make money and they want to get things done. And historically, you see, this is what people in the West struggle with. They don't understand the historical context that led to where China is now. If you talk to somebody who's in their 50s in China, in Shanghai, they will tell you, which they did with me. They chatted to me. They said, in the 80s, we had food rationing. Right, we got a stamp and we would be given a basket of food. Half of Shanghai was still rural and they had mass amounts of crime and poverty. In 30 years, their government, through a series of central control mechanisms, turned everything around. And whether or not you like that is not the point. It's that they did do it. And you can understand when you talk to somebody in Shanghai now, and they go, we love our government because look at what they've done. Shanghai is safe. It's highly efficient. Everything works. You can't say to them.
I just want to pick up on one thing, though.
Sure, yes.
They had some central control mechanisms, but the overwhelming story of China is that of Deng Xiaoping liberating the SME sector, which had previously been subjected to immense central control. And that basically led to an explosion in economic growth as the markets were liberalized. I'm talking about product markets, not stock markets or anything like that. And commerce was allowed to flourish for the first time in many decades. So it was actually a profound decentralizing move that led to the growth. And then when you find in recent years, that probably let's call it the last 10 or so, some of those measures have been tightened up again and the growth rate slows down. But I think your point is well taken that if the experience on the ground is that of massively improved lifestyle and reduced hardship, then people are not going to care about the polity that they're living under, what ism is attributed to it. And I mean, people say things like, oh, but you know, you haven't got freedom of speech in China. Well, we've just spent 5 years proving that we don't have freedom of speech anywhere because, you know, the moment you step out of the Overton window, the media and social media control mechanisms clamp down and your voice is suppressed. So I go, okay, so we don't have that here either. And, you know, do you have freedom of movement?
I mean, yeah. It's relative though, Nick.
Yeah.
It's relative. You can choose. You choose your hill that you want to die on. So if you want to be a political cartoonist in China, no, it's not a very good choice, right? You're not going to do very well there because you can't really criticize the government. The government of China is incredibly insecure, right? Incredibly insecure. You can't say anything positive about the president and you can't say anything negative about the president. They just don't want you to acknowledge them at all. Right.
Yeah.
And they are very bad at propaganda and they are very bad at marketing themselves. But if you want to go there, what's that? Yeah. They're very bad at propaganda. Yeah. Yeah. They're definitely. They don't do it very well. I mean, their whole style is just very cheap. They're not sophisticated in their propaganda output. Okay. But what I was saying though, Nick, is if you want to be a political cartoonist in, say, Europe, you still got a pretty good chance. Well, in America, you can do pretty well. You won't do well in China. But let's say you want to be, I don't know, a historian like David Irving, and you want to research the Holocaust or World War II or whatever. That you cannot do in Europe, but you can do that in China. So it depends on what it is you want to have freedom of expression around, so to speak. But it is relative in the sense that, I mean, it depends on what you want to discuss. South Africa, we have, I think, a great deal of freedom of speech. If you think about it, and if you compare it to other countries, we're still pretty good here in that sense because the government is so useless and so inept that it's not really able to crack down on us saying, you know, dissident things. The Chinese government is a lot more efficient at that, but it doesn't really go around. And that's the other thing. Again, it's always nuance. It doesn't go around arresting people and filling up its jails. It just basically gives fines and cuts off their social media access for 2 weeks or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Whereas in the States, you'll have the SWAT teams at 5 a.m. breaking down people's front doors.
Well, you really though. Yeah, that's what you'll see on social media. That might be the salient sort of video. I often look at those things and I just chuckle. Yeah, the ones at the moment are classic. the British ones where you have lots of handheld video, somebody was shooting from a cell phone, ostensibly the police have arrived at the front door to arrest them for posting something on social media. I look at those things and my intuition bells go off and say, that doesn't look real.
Nah.
It's very safe. Somebody's going to be...
Let's talk about something actual, like something that's real. Okay, so the first thing you notice when you go to Shanghai, and you might have noticed this when you're in China already. I mean, and the funny thing is that China works in sort of 5 to 10 year blocks. So if you were there in 2015, a lot has changed. Because they are so fast at what they do. But nonetheless, the first thing you notice is there are cameras everywhere. And China is quite technocratic. There's no doubt about it. It is quite technocratic. Everywhere you go, there are cameras. I think Shanghai's got around 15 million cameras installed, which is that's about one camera for every two people. That's a lot of cameras. I mean, I remember when I was at the airport in Chengdu and I was waiting at my gate, I looked above me and I counted five cameras pretty much looking in my direction. It is insane. But here's the thing, Nick, and this is where the tug of war starts happening. London also has a lot of cameras. I think let's say 2-4 million cameras, right? But there's a huge amount of crime. There's almost no crime in Shanghai. Is that attributed to the cameras or is it just a byproduct? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the political will as well to do something, to use the whatever devices they have at their disposal to do something and how this information is being used and processed, all of that. I remember in 2008, thereabouts, on one trip, I had the same experience happen twice, which was we went out to dinner with a local businessman. And there were questions that you ask in a restaurant where you could just see them get all of a sudden uptight and nervous, and they would sort of indicate to you with their hands, let's just leave that for later. And then what happened in both cases was they proposed a walk home, walk us back to our hotels. And on that walk, they then answered your questions. So these were people who, 16, 17 years ago, were concerned enough that they might be surveilled in a restaurant because they were talking to foreigners. That was actually a lively fear in their minds. And it's not as if we were asking them deep, dark political secrets. It was entirely commercial kind of questioning, is it difficult to get approval permits or something like that? How long does it take to register a company? Questions of this nature. I can't remember what they actually were. We would have done quite a lot of homework before getting there, but there would have been a few things that we were not clear on, So it was that kind of question. Some of those questions even just made them very nervous. They didn't want to be in a position of saying anything negative, they weren't even sure sometimes whether the answer would be negative, or perceived negatively.
That is exactly what I experienced. The locals still have I don't know where it comes from, but they have a deep sense of suspicion. If you don't look like them, if you're not Chinese, and even within China, there's a suspicion, like with the Uyghurs and the Tajiks and the other types of folks on the Western side. And that's why there's
on the periphery. Yeah, basically all the peripheral nations. Yeah, Tibet, yeah. Tibet, Uyghurs, Mongols, all these.
And I'm not sure where that comes from, where that suspicion or that paranoia that could be a result of state indoctrination. Propaganda. But the thing, hey, what's that?
It could be a result of propaganda. Othering in propaganda. It's difficult. And again, you're dealing through the barrier of a very different language and writing system. So I'd imagine a lot is lost in translation when you're trying to parse the propaganda or the information structure,
But the thing that I've noticed is that people are very quick to criticize aspects of the Chinese system. Now, one thing that is very clear to me, Nick, is that the Chinese system is not trying to impose itself on the rest of the world. In fact, the Chinese government has said that what works for us might not work for other countries. But yeah, you have NATO countries that are trying to impose their system everywhere else. You know, let's bring democracy, and they invade and they bomb. I don't see that happening within the Chinese system. They're just kind of doing their own thing. They are this entity that exists, that if the whole world around them disappeared, they would still be okay.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's not, despite its immense size and phenomenal sort of resourcing, China's still very dependent on the outside world.
Yes. But that's why you can, that's why you can access the outside world.
Sorry?
That's why you can access the outside world. They don't actually clamp down on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. Unlike Russia in this regard, you know, Russia's to a large extent autarkic in the sense that they could literally just close the borders and they'd be more or less fine. You know, there are very few commodities that they would not be able to obtain themselves. And I think it's probably the case that Russia's unique in the world in that regard. But China's not like that. You know, it does rely on heavily on imports of several commodities and of course on exports. So it's a different beast from Russia, I think.
I was when I was in Shanghai, I visited an economist friend of mine. He's been living in China for 29 years. He speaks fluent Chinese and his wife's Chinese. I think he has enough street cred to know about how the system works. And I asked him, we went for dinner and I asked him, I said, what in your view was the primary vector that led to the turnaround? And his answer was private property.
For me, it's so unremarkable to make that observation. Of course, it relates to what I was talking about earlier. It was liberalization and property rights becoming a thing and people being allowed to practice whatever trade they wanted and, you know, start whatever business they wanted and interact with whomever they wanted in the commercial space. You know, that's your free market sort of world inserting itself inside a society that had previously been controlled in a very top-down fashion. Also the story goes, you know. I wonder though, you know, okay, so your economist friend, did you ask him any questions about whether he felt that his life was materially impinged upon by any of the state apparatus?
Yes.
And what did he say?
So we had a very interesting conversation and I recorded some of it on my phone just so that I wouldn't forget about it if I wanted to reference him. But just for the sake of, because I haven't asked him if I can mention his name, so I won't mention his name now.
Yeah, don't mention his name.
But here's what's really interesting. So he said, look, so how it works in China is you can't become a citizen unless you're Chinese. There isn't really a path to citizenship. Even if you marry a Chinese person, if you yourself are not sort of ethnically Chinese, you're not really going to become a Chinese citizen at any point in your life. But you can be a resident.
Chinese meaning Han Chinese or?
Han.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, they are the super majority. About 90% of China is Han. Yeah. And he said to me, his little boy, he's got a 2-year-old kid. At the moment, the American embassy wants him to apply for his American passport. And he doesn't want that. He says he wants him to have a Chinese passport because he says, despite everything and despite the fact that he does like some of Trump, Trump's policies and some of the things that Trump says and does, he will still choose Xi Jinping. Despite everything, he'll still choose China as the better future for his kid. I mean, I found that absolutely fascinating and I asked, why? And he said, because despite the fact that there is censorship, he says that can change because he says in the early 2000s, China was fairly open internet-wise. And it depends on who is the president at the time. And people also forget this. You have this party structure that doesn't change. The party is the party. But internally, the members change. And sometimes you might have a more liberal president or you might have a more conservative president, legacy speaking. Currently, Xi Jinping is not very good. And he says this guy is not doing good things for the country. But the next president might.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I'm not entirely surprised to hear it. I've heard similar comments from other people who've ended up working in businesses in China for many years, that kind of thing. So that doesn't surprise me. There are similar discussions to be had, for example, about the Emirati cities. People talk about there are definitely circumscriptions of life that you have to put up with, but they sort of trade that off for whatever it is, crime-free, administratively efficient life, so people make these trade-offs all the time, and it's not at all surprising to me.
But the thing for me is I could never live there. So, I mean, here's the thing.
Why not?
You have
Why
to.
not? What's the thing?
Culture, I think, Nick. I think
Yes.
ultimately I cannot get past that language barrier. I cannot get past the cultural barrier. It's just too much for me.
So
I think if I'm just being, yeah.
I found the place back in the 2000s to be intensely alienating. And there were some things which were totally abhorrent to me. Just for the benefit of listeners, I mean, I know you know this, but I love the wilds. I go out into the bush as often as I can, and I'm completely smitten by forests and savannas and so on. Bird watching is a big hobby of mine. The attitudes towards wild animals in China completely freak me out.
Yes, I found that too.
Yes, it's this sort of laughing at the suffering of animals and things like that. Now, I'm far from like a sort of what's the word? Animal rights activist or something like this. I'm not a vegan. I'm not a not trying to throw red paint on people who are wearing fur coats or anything like that. But there was something dispiritingly inhumane about the whole attitude towards wildlife. And I've seen that outside of China too, when I've gone to visit the forests of the lower Zambezi River Valley in Mozambique, for example, and you arrive there to find that some local official has made a deal with the Chinese to tar a road and presumably to receive a whole stack of brown envelopes. And that road has been used to strip the forests of their hardwoods. And the forest is completely gone. They don't go do anything selectively. They'll just raise an entire forest to the ground, drive their trucks out, and with that, the road surface collapses, and the country is left with no trees, no roads, and a fat cat that's now emboldened by his newfound riches. So, from that perspective, it's incredibly rapacious. And I've seen that. I'm giving you one instance. I've seen that in numerous countries and in multiple places within single countries, which this very sort of predatory kind of in your face extraction.
And you notice this also in the wet markets or the night markets, the food markets. There's just no sense of respect.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, did you spend much time in rural areas? Did you talk to people? I imagine it's very different. You would have needed to work through a translator and so on. But I mean, were you talking to people in rural areas? Did you detect a difference in the sort of agrarian world from the city world?
Definitely. Look, in Shanghai, you don't see any animals because it's just a huge mega city. But when I was in Xinjiang, I mean, I was in a number of fairly small cities, and you still don't get the impression that they have a sense of respect for animals.
Yes.
It's almost as though the animals are just commodities.
Yeah, I was surprised when I was in Shanghai to see an article in one of those English language news sheets, and the thing that drew my attention was there was an image of an egret in on the one page, And the egret appeared to be tangled up in something. And you think, oh, that's quite surprising. Here's a story about how they rescued a bird out of an entanglement. And the article wasn't like that at all. It was basically an article about how stupid the bird was that it flew into this thing. And I was, whoa, what's that about? You know, where do you get to that? How do you get somebody thinking that that's the article you need to write and that will be consumed? And, you know, that goes beyond weirdness, you know. And that's what I meant by that sort of profound sense of alienation. And in so many interactions are just completely unrecognizable. And you know, you and I are people who come from a country that has remarkable ethnic and cultural diversity. And so we're used to things not being done according to the lights of your own immediate reference points and so on. We're completely used to that. We're much more tolerant of that kind of thing or accepting or able to navigate that kind of thing than I think most people in Europe and America are, for example. But still, when you arrive there with all the will in the world, you just find yourself hitting that brick wall of the alien, you know?
It's interesting though, because I don't know if you remember, but when you order a food, they tend to bring the entire animal to your table. And I think that is a sign of trust. It's like, this is what we're going to give you to eat. So here it is. I'm not used to seeing an entire lamb arriving on the table, you know, or an entire duck.
But it's a bit weird that, because it also implies that, you know, if they didn't do that, they would be doing something. If they didn't show you the animal, there would be some other con job being done in the background, or that the level of suspicion of restaurateurs in the society is such that you have to actually do that. I mean, can you imagine going to a steakhouse in Cape Town and insisting that the guy bring the cow? You know, it's a kind of a strange phenomenon. I'm not too sure that it speaks very well of them, you know. Can I ask you, though?
Yeah, sure.
Let's go back to that the surveillance story.
Yes, because we're gonna get grilled if we don't talk about that.
Yeah. So I mean, the imagery that we are asked to swallow is of swathes of people being locked out of their ability to purchase basic goods and services because they've had too many traffic fines or whatever, you know, and sleeping rough on the streets. And I remember from the apartheid era how people sleeping rough were often, you know, misrepresented, or, you know, a picture was taken of a guy sleeping in a park at day, and this is now a person who's been killed by the security forces, you know, that kind of thing. There's all sorts of misrepresentations that can take place. And I'm not saying the images even have to be faked. They can be real images. But did you get a sense that there's a system that's alive and well and poised to pounce on you and extract you from...
No. Yeah. No, Nick. So, okay. All right. So here we go. So you have to break apart what social credit means. Number one, if you have a criminal record in South Africa or in any country, you're going to struggle to get a bank loan. Now that is a social credit score, right off the bat. It is based on your behavior and you have a negative score, right?
Yeah.
I remember in the early 2000s when I was in Sydney, I don't know if it's still like this, but I remember then already that they were implementing, or they already had, a demerit system. So if you get like 15 points as a driver, and if you violate the road rules a certain amount of times, you lose all these points, and then you lose your ability to drive for 6 months or 12 months or whatever it is, and then you have to apply for a license again or something like that, right? That's also a social credit score, because it's based on your behavior. Now, social credit scoring, I'm not saying is good or bad. I'm not giving a moral judgment, but I'm saying that it is there and it is everywhere around us to different degrees. So, yes, there are social credit scores in China. You will struggle to get certain loans from the bank, for example, if you have a criminal record. But if you're talking about jaywalking, so this is a popular one. I jaywalked all the time in Shanghai, and in every city I was jaywalking. And why? Not because I was trying to be a rebel, but simply because it's not something that I think about. Being a South African, I crossed the road where it's safe.
Yeah.
So I don't look for a pedestrian crossing. I just go, okay, there aren't any cars coming. Let me quickly run across the road.
Yeah.
Now that's technically jaywalking, and in most mega cities like Shanghai, they don't really like that. Nonetheless, here I am. I didn't get any fines. I saw people riding motorbikes without helmets on. Apparently, that is against the law, but I saw it many times. People were jaywalking everywhere. There are no big screens with people's profiles appearing saying, well, this person has violated the law, so let's make a mockery of them. Saw none of that.
Yeah, okay. I guess the question is, you know, I often just like to remind people that social credit systems have been in place for many years. They're just not operated in a very centralized way. So, like the entire social process of having a reputation. You know, what is reputation? It's credit, social credit. So, if you're a Cape Town businessman and you develop a reputation for sharp dealing, you might find that I hear about it, and so when I get a phone call or an email from you, I'm looking at it and saying, "What's this guy on about?" No, I don't think I'm going to have a meeting with him. There's no good that can come of it. And so I've iced that person out of a segment of the economy by virtue of my own just perhaps prejudicial responses to their reputation or my perception of their reputation. And so when social credit has for millennia operated at a very local level, and what's happening now is that the technology is sort of starting to appear to maybe enable this reputation management to be conducted at an intensely centralized level, one where you have no connection to the person who's making the judgment, or the device that's making the judgment, the algorithm that's making the judgment. And I look at that as a model, and I say, well, that's going to be horribly decoherent. That's going to collapse. There will be so many contradictions. Automating that kind of thing is not possible. You know, the judgment I'm making about the businessman depends on huge range of factors. The reliability of the people telling me the stories about him, you know, or whether they stack up with my past experience, or whether I've heard something else that also confirms that, you know. There's lots of intuitional material coming into that decision about whether I exclude them from my commercial realm, whereas that stuff is all lost in algorithmic systems and at the top. But I also think it would decohere so quickly, the decisions that would be being made, that the system would become unmanageable fairly quickly.
Yes. Also, the thing, Nick, is, I mean, when I was in Urumqi, which is the capital of Xinjiang, I mean, it's a much smaller city, I think 4 million people or something, which by Chinese standards is not very big. I did still see a lot of surveillance cameras. But something that occurred to me while I was there is, how do you know that every single one of those cameras is operational? We know that we have cameras here in South Africa that have, they're just empty boxes. They're just there as an illusion, sure, to trick you into thinking there's a camera. I mean, yes, if so many people are jaywalking and not wearing helmets and all that kind of thing, and it does sometimes look like chaos, like it's just, the streets are just a mess. Yeah, you go, okay, well, I don't know. Are those cameras really working? Is it just there for appearances?
Yeah, I mean,
this is the other thing. The propaganda of the West makes it seem like the Chinese government is unbelievably efficient.
Yeah.
And it's not.
No, of course not. And also that Chinese businesses are unbelievably efficient. I mean, I ran several experiments there, you know, taking South African factory managers through, you know, sending them on tours through plants and asking them to register efficiencies at every point in production. And the one businessman who's still, I'm still very close to him, I'll never forget, you know, he came back and he said, it's not that they're inefficient in some areas, they're inefficient in all areas. There were more people involved in each task. There was less thoroughness in each task. There were more rejects. There were more production errors. There were more quality control problems. You know, they reported back in this way. And yet we were all at that stage believing that you couldn't compete with these Chinese guys because they were so ruthlessly efficient and all the factors of production cost less than everything. That didn't actually really stack up when you scratched beneath the surface a bit. So you mentioned earlier in the conversation the concept of paranoia or of insecurity on behalf of the party, you know. And I think people lose sight of that the main drive towards centralized control is perhaps not the accretion of vast resources or an ego trip, but a fundamental insecurity. That, you know, the reason you want to see things centralized is you're terrified about what might happen in a decentralized world.
Exactly. Yeah, well, but also, the last 5 years, one of the big talking points that we've heard, you know, the skeptic folks talking about is sovereignty. Everything's about sovereignty. We've got to get these foreign forces out of our country. Okay, but that's what China has been doing.
And can I link it back? Let me link it back to your observation about the lack of subtlety in the propaganda. I think that's, you know, I'd mentioned the example of the rapacious behavior around the forests, but I would never for a minute believe that the destructiveness of Chinese activities in Africa exceeded that of American activities. You know, there what happens is you won't see something, you know, naked like that, build a thin road, extract the forest, leave a sand road behind. That kind of activity would not be typical of America's modus operandi, but what is typical is the undermining of governments, and not because they're doing something wrong or because they're infringing on human rights, simply because they're actually starting to assert a degree of independence or to offer the potential for a country to become wealthier. You know, Americans want cheap resources, so they want instability in Africa, and they do that through an elaborate network of CIA cutout organizations. They can turn, we've seen it around the world, you know, Georgia, Nepal being recent phenomena, where there's just a kind of a switch that's turned on. And the hand of the CIA is palpable. And there you go. Suddenly everything's upended in that country.
But I want to also point out just on that surveillance issue, which we haven't touched on yet, is the surveillance in China is very blatant. It's in your face, right? It is everywhere, and they have this approach where they want you to know that it's there. Mm. Let's compare that to Palantir. Let's compare that to Stargate. Yes. Let's compare that to what's going on the other side of the world, where it's all subversive. You're not sure what's going on your phone, for example. You know what I mean?
No, we've all had that creepy experience where you do a Google search and for the next 3 days you're pelted with advertising for the thing that you searched for, that kind of thing. Yeah. Mm. And you know, oh, I see my information is being used in a really quite arcane fashion, you know. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I find Palantir a much more creepier phenomenon than the Chinese Communist Party, no question. Let's take ourselves back in Europe a couple of hundred years. Did the average person walking around in Europe believe that somebody was watching him? I think he did. There was a real visceral belief that God was watching them, your every move. Mm-hmm. So was life very different for that European versus one who now has, you can see the cameras, you know, somebody is watching him. In some ways that sort of the dominant belief structure was far more invasive, because you had this a AGI, you know, not only watching you when you had the camera pointing at you, but watching you at all times and knowing your every thought and action. And, you know, if that sense of the world was still manageable, then, you know, how different is that compared to the modern case? And I guess it comes down to what is done with the information, you know?
Well, exactly. Okay, yeah. So let me give you an anecdote. So we were, we drove through the Taklamakan Desert, and most people don't even know what it is, but it's, I think it's the world's second largest moving desert. I mean, it feels alive. The dunes are moving all the time. It's an incredibly big desert, and you forget that a technologically advanced country like China does have deserts. We drove through from, so we did a cross section from the north to the south of the desert, which was about 11-hour drive. And we stopped off at what they would consider a type of Grand Canyon, very, very beautiful rock formation that looks like a Grand Canyon because of the way the mountain kind of runs parallel to itself. It's gorgeous. We are in the middle of nowhere, but there was a bylaw that stated for the 2 weeks that we were in Xinjiang, in that province, no drones were allowed across the entire province because it fell into the time period of the 70th anniversary of the autonomy of the Xinjiang province. It's a big thing. Yeah. Huge, huge celebrations. Yeah, yeah. You're going to say?
No. I'm listening. Very interesting.
Oh, right. And Xi Jinping flew to the province to form part of the celebrations. We were just there at the same time. So for 2 weeks, no drones were allowed anywhere. Okay. But we're now in the middle of the desert, and we hear about this mini Grand Canyon story. And the guy that we're with, well, that's with us, one of the film crew, he decides he's going to send his drone up in the sky and just get some beautiful footage. I mean, we're in the middle of nowhere. Mm. I kid you not, Nick, about 20 minutes later, the police pitch up and they ask us who was flying the drone.
Wow.
In the middle of nowhere. All right. We'll come to that in a second. So then they took down the information of the drone because all drones have to be registered. Took it down. They asked to look at the footage. No issues. Didn't have to delete anything. They said, look, you may not fly drones. Okay. Then we sat in the car towards trying to figure this out. Okay, so number one, it's a DJI. Yeah, it's a DJI drone. So we think that because it uses satellites to know where it is, mm-hmm. it's sending that information to the authorities. That's, I think, what's going on. And it's fairly accurate. The fact that they came straight to us and asked who flew the drone in the middle of a desert, that is very, very creepy, and that I don't like.
Hmm. No, that is rather spooky. Yeah.
I don't like the word communist because I don't really know what that means anymore. Nick, when you go to China, you don't see communism. You do see it, but you don't see it. The whole thing doesn't make sense.
It does sound.
But what is true?
Communism and
yeah, it has features. Yeah,
capitalism. You know, so yeah, it's not a communist system.
No, but the government does control the banks and it does control the utilities,
enterprises, etc. Yeah.
But yet it works, and this is the tug of war, the philosophical conundrum that I find myself having is that I cannot make a claim that it's dystopian, and I cannot make a claim that it's rainbows.
Yeah, it could be the case that type of system will never see Chinese people have their living standards elevated to the level of Europe or America over the last 50 years or whatever. Because they're still sitting at what, like a tenth of that level, you know. And I always remind people, like, can you imagine cutting 90% of your consumption? You know, just imagine, like, I said to you, look, you can live exactly the same way as you always have, but you have to spend 90% less. What, you know, it doesn't even make sense. You can't do it. So like a 90% cut in consumption it puts you, you know, in the position, if you like, of a hypothetical Chinese counterpart. That's a long way to catch up still. And I'm not sure that it's going to happen under that kind of system. That would be my sense, is that they actually have accepted a trade-off between the potential for growth and the loss of control. Did you ever encounter a sense of that they were regarding you as sort of disgusting, or some kind of racist attitude towards you, or looking at you as if you were like an alien? Did you get that sense, or do you think it was fairly, they were not?
No, I don't think they looked down on me. I certainly think that they feel themselves to be very superior. I'm looking at the time now. We're coming in for a landing, but I think there's a lot that we can learn from them. Their big selling point is technological advancement. I think there's a lot more to life than just that. We spoke about wildlife and animals, and like you, I prefer being in Africa. I want to be able to go into the bush, and I don't want to go through checkpoints to do that, you know. But I think there are sort of cultural characteristics of the Chinese that I think we should adopt. I think when last 5 years, the people that we've been chatting to have all been talking about the importance of community and family. Well, they have it. They do have it, and we can learn from them in that. But I think there are other things that we can learn to avoid. And I think there's a lot of sort of technocratic stuff there that I just don't like.
Sure. Well, that's a good summary, Jim. It's been very interesting. I really appreciated chatting to you and getting some firsthand reporting from a scallywag on the ground.
Nick, how can my audience follow you?
I'm on X at Nick Hudson CT, and also on Substack with a similar handle. So that's it.